Random House Audiobooks presents Star Wars, The New Jedi Order, Vector Prime, by R.A. Salvatore.
It was too peaceful, out here surrounded by the vacuum of space, and with only the continual hum of the twin ion drives breaking the silence. While she loved these moments of peace, Leia Organa Solo also viewed them as an emotional trap, for she had been around long enough to understand the turmoil she would find at the end of this ride, like the end of every ride lately. Leia paused a moment before she entered the bridge of the Jade Saber, the new shuttle her brother Luke had built for his wife Mara Jade. Before her, Mara and Jaina sat comfortably side by side at the controls, talking and smiling. Leia focused on her daughter Jaina, 16 years old, but with the mature and calm demeanor of a veteran pilot. Leia saw much of herself in the girl, and that notion set Leia back a bit, for she recognized that when she looked at Jaina, she was seeing not a reflection of herself, but an image of the girl she had once been. A twinge of sadness caught her as she considered her own life now. A diplomat, a bureaucrat, a mediator, always trying to calm things down, always working for the peace and prosperity of the New Republic. Did she miss the days when the most common noise around her had been the sharp blare of a blaster or the hiss of a lightsaber? Perhaps, Leia had to admit. But in looking at Jaina and those simmering dark eyes, she could take vicarious pleasure. Another twinge, jealousy, caught her by surprise, as Mara and Jaina erupted into laughter over some joke Leia had not overheard. But she pushed the absurd notion far from her mind, as she regarded her sister-in-law, Luke's wife and Jaina's tutor in the ways of the Jedi. When Leia considered the fires that constantly burned in Mara's green eyes, she understood that the woman could give to Jaina things that Leia could not, and that those lessons would prove valuable indeed to her daughter. And so she forced aside her jealousy and was merely glad that Jaina had found such a friend. Leia crossed through the open doorway. "How much longer?" she asked. In answer, Jaina increased the magnification on the forward screen, and there appeared an image of two planets. Parked halfway between them loomed a Mon Calamari battlecruiser, the Mediator, one of the newest ships in the New Republic fleet. "They're at their closest," Mara observed, referring to the planets. She turned to Jaina. "Both Ramamul and Osarian are ground based technologically, but they both got missiles that can hit each other from this close distance. That's why your mother chose to come out now." "You're expecting a fight?" Jaina asked, and neither Leia nor Mara missed the sparkle in her eye. "The Mediator will keep them behaving," Leia said, hopefully. Mara looked back to the screen and shook her head, unconvinced. "It'll take more than a show of force to stop this catastrophe," she replied.
"Indeed, it has been escalating by all reports," came a melodic voice from the doorway, and the protocol droid C-3PO walked onto the bridge. "It started as a simple mining dispute over mineral rights, but now the rhetoric is more appropriate for some kind of holy crusade."
"It's the leader on Ramamur," Mara remarked, "Nom Anur. He's reached down and grabbed his followers by their most basic instincts, weaving the dispute against Osarian into a more general matter of tyranny and oppression. Don't underestimate him." "I can't begin to give you a full list of tyrants like Nom Anur that I've dealt with," Leia said with a resigned shrug.
"Not like him," Mara replied somewhat softly.
And the sudden weakness in her voice reminded Leia and Jaina that Mara, despite her nearly constant bravado and overabundance of energy, was seriously ill, with a strange and thankfully rare disease that had killed dozens of others and against which the best doctors in the New Republic had proven completely helpless. Of those who had contracted the molecular disorder, only Mara and one other remained alive, and that other person, being studied intently on Coruscant, was fast dying.
incoming ships, Jaina announced.
Blips had appeared on her sensor viewer as if from nowhere.
Four of them, Mara confirmed.
Even as she spoke, the warning buzzers began to go off.
From Osarian.
She turned her curious expression up to Leia.
They're afraid that my going to Ramamul to meet with Nom Anur will only heighten his stature, both among the Ramamulians and throughout the sector, Leia reasoned. This was a notion not without credence, and one that she had debated endlessly before making the decision to come here. Z-95 headhunters, Mara said derisively of the closing craft, an antiquated starfighter. But they're coming on fast. Both she and Jaina looked to Leia for instructions, for while the Jade Saber was Mara's ship, this was Leia's mission.
Lose them, she said determinedly, a request that neither of the pilots needed to hear twice.
Jaina reversed throttle, fishtailing the ship about in a brutal 180.
Try a... Mara started to say, but she lost the words as Jaina pulled a snap roll right and then another right behind it.
Mara glanced over her right shoulder between Jaina and Leia, and both followed her lead long enough to see that two of the four attack ships had altered course accordingly, laser cannons blasting away.
Coming in hot, Mara cried.
Jaina couldn't even hear her. She was turned inward now, was feeling the force coursing through her, was registering every movement of her enemies and reacting instinctively, playing the game three moves ahead. Before Mara had even begun to speak, Jaina had brought the ship's nose about to starboard to directly face one of the incoming headhunters. The Jade Saber's defensive array screeched and lit up, warning of a lock-on. But then the closer ship, coming from port, passed right under the Jade Saber, and Jaina fired the repulsor lifts, bouncing the Jade Saber up and sending the poor headhunter into a wild spinning roll. The closing ship from starboard let fly its concussion missile, but it and the headhunter zipped right underneath the elevated Jade Saber. Before the three women could even begin to catch their breath, another ship streaked in. An X-Wing. The new XJ version of the starfighter, its own laser cannons blasting away from its wingtips. Not at the Jade Saber, though, but at the headhunter that had just gone past.
Who is that? Leia asked.
And Jaina, equally curious, brought the Jade Saber about hard. The headhunter snap rolled left and dived, but the far superior X-Wing stayed on her, lasers scoring hit after hit, depleting her shields and then blasting her apart into a million pieces.
A Jedi, Mara and Jaina said together,
and Leia, when she paused to collect the force sensations about her, concurred.
Fast to the Mediator, Leia instructed her daughter, and Jaina swung the Jade Saber about yet again. Another headhunter's out, Jaina informed them, watching the blips on her sensor screen. And the two others are vectoring away. Only one pursuing, the X-Wing.
Jaina took the Jade Saber at a swift but steady pace toward the distant Mediator and took her down easily.
I hope to meet with Nom Anur tomorrow, Leia explained as the three moved down to the landing bay.
A contingent of New Republic Honor Guard stood waiting there, along with Commander Akdul.
By all reports, we should be rested before dealing with him. But first, it seems I get to meet with our savior Jedi, Leia added dryly, looking back behind the Jade Saber to see the X-Wing gliding into rest. Worth Skinner, Jaina remarked, recognizing the markings under the canopy on the starfighter.
Why am I not surprised? Leia asked, and she blew a sigh. Akdul came over to them then and extended his formal greetings to the distinguished guests, but Leia's reaction set him back on his heels.
Why did you send him out? She snapped, motioning toward the Jedi's docking X-Wing.
Why do you assume that Worth Skinner flew out at my command? The cool Commander Akdul responded. Why would you assume that Worth Skinner heeds any order I might give?
The young man was fast approaching, pulling off his helmet and giving his shock of blonde hair a tousle as he walked. Leia stepped out to intercept him.
Worth Skinner, she said. Do you even understand that your stupidity likely escalated an already impossible situation?
Leia's voice was as firm and cold as anyone present had ever heard it.
They were attacking you, Skinner retorted. Four of them. And we planned to avoid them. Avoid, Leia explained, and our graciousness in not mentioning this unfortunate incident would have bought me the bargaining capital I need to bring some kind of conciliation from Osarian toward Ramamul. But now, we can't do that, can we? Now I'll have to deal with an incident. The Jedi glared all around, then turned on his heel and walked briskly away. Leia did manage a bit of a smile when she heard Mara behind her tell Jaina, "Maybe Nom Anur has met his match." Mara looked down at the table at the pile of leaflets Commander Akduul had given them. Colorful propaganda from Nom Anur. He railed against the New Republic, against the Jedi, and against anything mechanical and technological, and somehow tied all of these supposed ills to the cultural disease that engulfed the society of the planet Osarian. "Why does Nom Anur hate the Jedi?" Jaina asked. "What do we have to do with the struggle between Osarian and Ramamul? I never even heard of these planets until you mentioned that we'd be coming here." "Nom Anur hates the New Republic," Mara replied, "and he hates the Jedi as symbols of the New Republic." "Is there anything Nom Anur doesn't hate?" Leia asked dryly. "Don't take him lightly," Mara warned yet again. "He was stirring up anger against the Jedi long before he ever came to Ramamul. Here, he's just found a convenient receptacle for his wrath. And with the Jedi Knights scattered throughout the galaxy, and so many of them following their own agendas, Nom Anur might just find plenty of ammunition to add to his arguments," Leia added grimly. "If we can't bring some sense of order to the galaxy, particularly to isolated planets like Osarian and Ramamul, then we're no better than the Empire," Mara remarked. "We're better than the Empire," Leia insisted. "Not in Nom Anur's eyes," Jaina said. "He's the strangest man I ever met," Mara explained. "Even when I tried to use the Force to gain a better perspective on him, I drew a blank, as if the Force had nothing to do with him." Leia and Jaina looked at her curiously. "No," Mara corrected. "More like he had nothing to do with the Force." "The perfect disconnected ideologue," Leia thought. "Wonderful." Danny Kui looked out from the western Terra Tower of X-Gal 4, a solitary scientific outpost on the outer rim planet of Belkaden in the Delonbian sector. Danny came here often at this time of day to watch the Belkaden sunset filtering through the Dalarala trees. Of late, those sunsets had been more spectacular for some reason, with tinges of orange and green edging the typical pinks and crimsons. At 21, she was one of the youngest members of the 15 stationed here, and one of only four women. She had been on Belkaden for 3 years, an original member of X-Gal 4. Her homeworld, a core planet, was badly overcrowded, and for independent Danny, even trips to other nearby worlds didn't seem to alleviate the feeling of being squeezed by too many people. Thus, the notion that there might be life beyond the galaxy, the thought of something undiscovered, excited the young woman. Behind her, from one of the windows of the station center structure, Yeoman Carr watched Danny's every move. He was the most recent to join the crew, but it hadn't taken him long to recognize that many of the others looked up to her. She was the one he could not ignore. "Early again?" came a voice behind Yeoman Carr. He turned to regard the speaker, though he knew from the voice, particularly the teasing tone, that it was Benson Tomry. "Or is it that you're still here from last night?" Tomry went on, and he gave a chuckle. Yeoman Carr smiled, but did not reply. The others of the station thought it was simply newbie excitement, the feeling they had all shared when they had first arrived, that the elusive extragalactic signal could happen at any time. In their eyes, Yeoman Carr had taken that excitement to the extreme, perhaps, but he had done nothing, he was confident, to arouse any real suspicion.
"He'll get bored with it soon enough," said Garth Bryce, another of the night shift controllers, sitting up on the higher level, where the comfortable chairs, the gaming table, and the food could be found.
The room was elliptical, with a wide view screen on the front wall and 7 control pods before it. Yeoman Carr forced another smile at the remark, and made his way down to his usual position at pod 3.
Danny Kui entered next, moving down to pod 4, the central pod, the one whose viewing scan overlapped the quadrant scanned by all six of the others. Then came the last member of the night shift, Ti-Ubo Duol, the Twi'lek woman, the only non-human, as far as the others knew, among the 15 at the station. After setting the forward screen to cycle through the smaller viewers of each individual pod, Danny joined the others in the upper level, and on her suggestion, they began a four-way game of Dejarik. At his post, Yeomin Carr, as he did every night and most days when he could inconspicuously hang out about the pod, dialed down the volume so that only he would hear any telltale signals, and covertly locked his dish on Sector L-30. The location he knew to be the entry point. Vector Prime.
"You want to play?"
came Benson Tomry's call.
"No,"
Yeomin Carr answered, as he had for every night in the last few weeks.
"Work to do."
As the night lengthened, Benson Tomry was soon snoring contentedly, while Ti-Ubo and Garth Bryce argued and tittered about everything and nothing at all, and Danny continued to play Dejarik, but against three computer opponents. Then it happened. Yeomin Carr caught the slight blip on the very edge of the pod's viewscreen. He froze, staring intently, and dialed up the volume just a bit. It came again, accompanied by the rhythmic signal that could only emanate from a ship. Yeomin Carr could hardly find his breath. After all the years of preparation, he waited a moment longer to confirm the positioning. Then he quickly shifted his dish all the way over to Sector L1. That would buy him a couple of hours on this screen. Yeomin Carr dialed his volume back up to normal, then stood up and stretched, his movement attracting Danny's attention.
"I need to take a walk."
The woman nodded. "It's quiet enough," she replied. As soon as the control room's door was closed behind him, Yeomin Carr removed his hard boots and broke into a dead run. He had to pause when he got into his private quarters, forcing himself to steady his breathing. It would not do for the executor to see him so obviously rattled, nor would it do for the executor to see him in this horrid human disguise, he reminded himself. Humans did not typically paint their skins or mutilate any part of their bodies to show their worship to the worthy pantheon. Human eyes did not droop with the appealing bluish sacks beneath them, as did Yuzhong Vong eyes. And the human forehead was flat, not enticingly sloped, as were those of the Yuzhong Vong. No, even after these months as the advanced agent of the Praetorite Vong, Yeomin Carr could hardly stand the sight of the infidels. He stripped off his clothing and moved his hand up beside his nose, his fingers working at the obscure seam at the side of his left nostril, the contact point for the Uglith masker. Sensitive to his touch and well-trained, the creature immediately responded, and Yeomin Carr clenched his teeth and fought hard to steady his trembling as the thousands of tiny grappling tendrils pulled free of his pores, the Uglith masker rolling back over his nose and separating across his cheeks. The seam widened down his chin and neck and the front of his torso, his fake skin peeling back, rolling down, until he merely stepped out of it. The Uglith masker shuffled across the floor toward the dark closet, making slurping, sucking sounds as it moved. And the Yuzhong Vong warrior stood at the mirror regarding his true form admiringly. And now, showing his ornamental disfigurements and tattoos, he was ready to address the executor on this most important matter. He moved to the side of the room to open his locker. And as the top rolled back, the platform inside raised up, showing a brown cloth covering a pair of ball-like lumps. Gently, Yeomin Carr removed the cloth and considered the lumps, his villips. He turned to the one on the right and gently stroked its ridged top, until the single break in the membranous tissue, a hole that resembled an eye socket, puckered to life. Yeomin Carr continued to stroke the creature, to awaken the consciousness-joined villip more than halfway across the galaxy. He felt the pull of that creature a moment later, and knew the sensation to mean that the executor had heard his call and was likewise awakening his own villip.
Yeoman Carr moved his hand back fast, as that central hole opened wide, and then rolled back over itself, the villip inverting, to assume the appearance of the head of the executor. Yeoman Carr bowed respectfully.
"It is time,"
he said, glad to be using his native language once more.
"You have silenced the station?"
the executor asked.
"I go now,"
Yeoman Carr explained.
"Then go,"
the executor said, and with typical discipline, not even inquiring about the details of the incoming signal, broke communication. The night was chill, but that only invigorated Yeoman Carr. He ran flat out to the tall girder-work tower, the only structure outside the compound, and then up he went to the top of the 100-meter tower. Chill winds buffeted him, giving him an idea. So he went to work on the connection between cable and junction box, gently, easing out one rivet, turning open one screw. The others, if they ever managed to get this far along in their repairs, would think this damage to be the result of the constant wind and the often harsh Belkaden weather. Secure that the connection was broken, the warrior started back for the compound. But he stopped fast, noting a movement along the ground not far away. He smiled widely as he held up a reddish-brown beetle with hooked mandibles and a single protruding tubular tongue. He had not seen any of the beetles since he brought them to Belkaden, and he was glad to learn that they had already traveled this far across the planet's surface.
Dani Qui would soon learn the reason that her precious sunsets were becoming somewhat tinted.
In his own room again, Yeoman Carr went to the closet, bidding the Uglith masker back to him. A quick trip to the mirror showed him that the disguise was complete. A few minutes later, he was back in the control room to find Teubo and Garth huddled about Pod 3, with Danny working to reposition Pod 4 to the same alignment.
"Yeoman," Danny called. "Come here, quick! A signal!"
And there it was, on the screen and throughout the audio lead. The clear signal of something very large crossing through the galactic rim into the galaxy.
"Extra galactic,"
Danny said seriously. With a hesitation in his step that betrayed his uncomfortable feelings, Jason Solo followed his Uncle Luke into the council chamber. They had come to Coruscant so that Luke could accept an invitation to address the New Republic Advisory Council concerning his plans to re-establish the Jedi Council. But there was no doubt in Luke's mind that he would face some tough opposition on that matter, even from some counselors he considered his friends. What made it all the worse for Jason was the fact that he hoped his Uncle Luke's opponents proved victorious in this matter. After the somewhat hypocritical pleasantries and formalities that seemed to go on and on, Chief of State Boris Kfelia looked Luke right in the eye and asked in the gravest of tones,
"You have heard the initial reports from the mediator?"
"Leia will be meeting with Nom Anur soon, I am told," Luke replied, avoiding the obvious.
"A meeting complicated already,"
Borsk said. "I heard of the intervention," Luke admitted.
"The Osarians were wrong to try to intercept a New Republic envoy,"
remarked Cal Omus of Alderaan, perhaps Luke's strongest ally on the Council.
"A convenient excuse for our Jedi hero to rush to the rescue,"
Fjor Rodan shot back. A human from Kominor, Rodan had requested Luke's presence at the council. Fjor stood up and waved his fist.
"Why, I have heard of battles along the Outer Rim as far out as the Angor system. Jedi swooping in, torpedoes flying against innocent citizens."
"Smugglers, you mean," Cal Omus retorted.
"Many who aided in the overthrow of the Empire,"
Fjor Rodan shot back.
"And you take that as an excuse for their current illegal activities?"
"The Jedi Knights are not the law,"
Nuk Nuv, one of Luke's more vocal detractors, pointed out.
"So they should be told,"
Fjor Rodan said.
"Chief Felia, perhaps we should consider a resolution against the Jedi. A strong statement demanding that they end all policing efforts that have not been explicitly authorized by this council."
And so the shouting began.
Jason and Luke left the council chamber a short while later, the war of words raging behind them. To Jason's surprise, Luke was wearing a satisfied smile. Both Fjor Rodan and Njuk Njuv tipped their hands in the last part of the exchange, he explained to the obviously confused Jason. With the smugglers? Luke nodded. So you think that some of the counselors are working with the smugglers, that the Jedi are giving a hard time to? Luke shrugged. I don't know that, he admitted, but it seems to fit. And what are you going to do about it? Luke stopped. Jason did too, the pair turning to face each other directly. We have 100 Jedi Knights, setting their own agendas throughout the galaxy, Luke explained. That's why we need the Jedi Council, to establish a singular purpose and direction.
Is that what it means, to be a Jedi Knight? Jason asked bluntly,
a question Luke had been hearing from him many times in the last few months. In Jason's idealistic 16-year-old eyes, a properly trained Jedi Knight needed no bureaucrats to guide his actions, and putting that governing layer there would steal the mystery of being a Jedi. I have not put my ideas on solid footing yet, Luke said. And Jason knew that to be as polite a reply and as much of a concession as he would ever get. They said no more as they left the Senate building, making their way down to the docks, where Han, Anakin, and Chewbacca were working on the Millennium Falcon.
That night, Nom Anur's advisor, Shok Tinoctin, informed him that the Jade Saber had made orbit.
Leia Organa Solo is aboard her, along with her daughter and Mara Jade Skywalker. They are Jedi. Worthy adversaries, he stammered.
Leia is not true Jedi, or at least she has not embraced her Jedi powers, from what I have been told, Nom Anur replied. Nor is her daughter a proven Jedi.
But Mara Jade is counted among the strongest of the Jedi Knights, Shok Tinoctin pointed out.
Nom Anur turned a glare upon the man, reminding him of who was the boss here and who the mere attendant.
Mara Jade has her own problems to consider, he reminded.
Shok Tinoctin didn't take comfort in that.
She should be long dead, he dared to say.
Nom Anur smiled and scratched his head.
He had been wearing his Ooglith masker for a long time and was literally itching to take the thing off, but he hadn't the time, of course, and in truth he didn't want even the trusted stooge Tinoctin to see his true self-disfigured face. His face, with its strange eye, the one he had taken out with the sharpened end of a burning stick, a reflection of Nom Anur's highest show of devotion on the day he was awarded the position of executor among the Yuuzhan Vong and the first advance scout for the Praetorite Vong invasion force.
I am impressed with Mara Jade's ability to resist the spores, Nom Anur admitted.
I shall escort them in,
Shok Tinoctin offered. And after a confirming nod from Nom Anur, the man turned on his heel and walked from the room.
Nom Anur rested back in his chair. He was looking forward to this meeting, simply so that he could gauge the effect of his infection upon Mara Jade, and so that he might learn more of the Jedi in general. That was one of his missions here, to identify those most dangerous foes, and to find some way to minimize their effectiveness. Then Nom Anur noticed on one of his many security holocams that Shok Tinoctin was returning with Leia, Jaina, and Mara. Given the sensory powers of the Jedi, Nom Anur realized that it would be a mistake to allow Leia and the others into these private quarters. He hustled to his door and pushed out into the hall, arriving just as Shok Tinoctin led the group around the bend in the corridor.
"I bring greetings from the Council of the New Republic," Leia said in formal greeting.
"You bring interference where it is not wanted," Nom Anur countered.
"We have come as arranged," Leia said. "An agreement between you and Chief of State Boris Kfelia, I believe."
"I agreed that an emissary could come," Nom Anur admitted. "To what end, I do not know."
"This is about the fate of two worlds," Leia retorted.
"Who need nothing from the hypocritical New Republic," Nom Anur added.
Leia shook her head and sputtered a few undecipherable words.
Order your battlecruiser to destroy the Osarian's ability to attack Ramamul,
Nom Anur said.
Then peace will prevail, and so will prosperity, but it will be prosperity for Ramamul, and not Osarian, not the favored elite of the New Republic.
If you cared for the people of Ramamul, you'd sit down and negotiate away this budding war, Leia said bluntly.
I thought that was what we just did,
Nom Anur said. Leia's expression turned incredulous.
Not what you expected?
Nom Anur taunted.
I think our positions are clear. I bid you turn about, back to your silly little flying box, and away from Ramamul. I'm afraid that I have lost patience with your foolishness.
Leia stared at him long and hard, then turned on her heel and stormed away, sweeping up Jaina and Mara in her wake.
The scent of the Kum Spur was strong on Mara Jade Skywalker's breath,
Shock-Tinoctin remarked.
And she wasn't as strong, Nom Anur added. I could see it in the way she walked and held herself.
Supremely pleased with himself, the executor headed for his private quarters. Luke and Jason found the Millennium Falcon right where they'd left it, and judging from the sounds coming from the bay, the clank of metal wrenches and the stream of muttered curses, they figured that Han and Chewie were still trying to figure out how to fix the thing. On the way to Coruscant, Han had given the controls over to Anakin, his younger son, who was more than a bit jealous that Mara often let Jaina fly the Jade Saber, and the 15-year-old predictably had pulled a few hot-dogging maneuvers on the way down. By the time Han had managed to take back the controls for the remnant of the flight to dock, the Falcon was listing badly, with one engine and several repulsor lifts firing intermittently and unpredictably. Even now, secured in the bay, one of those repulsors popped off now and again, jolting the ship's edge up a few degrees to bounce back down as the repulsors sputtered back out. Luke and Jason exchanged a smile as the Falcon went up yet again, nearly onto its side, then dropped fast to horizontal slamming down against the floor. From somewhere on board, they heard R2-D2 screech.
Chewie!
Han cried from the ship, just beyond the open landing ramp. This was followed by a thud, a swear or two, and a wrench bouncing down the ramp to clang out into the docking bay. Han staggered down behind, covered in grease and sweat, muttering every step of the way. He bent to retrieve the wrench, but stopped and glanced up at his returning son and brother-in-law. He cocked his head at Luke.
How'd your meeting go?
Wonderful, Luke answered sarcastically.
They've got their problems, Han said. The New Republic Advisory Council is finding that managing a galaxy isn't as easy as they believed.
So they find scapegoats, Luke said. Someone along the Outer Rim is banging blasters with smugglers. Jedi, they believe. And that's not to the liking of Yor-Uddan, Nuke-Nuv.
Probably costing them a fortune,
Han reasoned with a wry grin.
Which means they're laying it on you. Well, what are we going to do about it?
Didn't you tell me that Lando was on the Outer Rim, mining asteroids or something? Luke asked.
He's out there,
Han replied.
Pair of planets called Dubrillion and Destrillion, near an asteroid system he modestly named Lando's Folly.
I need a little insider information, Luke continued. Lando always seems to know what's going on, and if I get the story, I might be able to use it to persuade a couple of counselors to see things my way.
You want to go and visit him?
Han asked.
He's not on especially good terms with the New Republic these days.
Is he ever?
He's likely running a few side businesses the New Republic would see as less than legitimate.
Isn't he always?
That brought a chuckle from Han, but just for a moment.
What about Mara? He asked seriously.
They'll be back from their meeting with Nom Anur soon, and from what I hear, things didn't go very well.
That hit home to Luke. A reminder, as everything seemed to be a reminder, that his beloved wife was ill. No medicine, no therapy had come close to treating the rare disease, and only her own internal strength, her use of the Force, was keeping it in check. Han said,
Maybe a run to the Outer Rim far away from the Council would do Mara and my wife good.
Luke shrugged and nodded, and so it seemed settled.
They heard R2 beeping wildly then. Chewie wailed, and the number 7 repulsor lift coil fired to life. And then there came another explosion from inside the Falcon, and the coil sputtered out. Anakin came storming down the landing ramp.
"That's it," he grumbled. "I'm done."
Before Han could even begin to yell at him, though, a huge hairy paw landed on the boy's shoulder and yanked him back inside. And Anakin's feeble attempt at any protest was blasted away by a tremendous Wookiee roar. Han blew a sigh.
Teenagers.
Danikui pored over the charts, checking coordinates and vectors. It seemed as if their incoming asteroid, racing along faster than any natural object they had ever witnessed, would soon enough sail into the Helska system. Given its present course and speed, and there seemed to be no reason to expect either to change, it would collide with the fourth planet. "What do we know of that planet?" Danny asked.
Garth Bryce shrugged. "Well, there isn't much in the data banks about the Helska system."
"Point the orbiting scopes toward that fourth planet, then," Danny instructed. "Let's find out what it's made of."
"Ice,"
Yeoman Carr said from Pod 7. The other scientists in the room turned to regard him.
"Once we determined that the asteroid would make a close pass or a hit, I took some shots from our orbiting scope,"
Yeoman Carr explained.
"I could detect nothing more substantial than ice and vapor."
"If it's nothing but ice, then that asteroid will disintegrate it,"
Benson Tomry remarked, and a grin widened on his face. All of them had been excited when they discovered that the incoming asteroid was on a path for a collision, for none had ever witnessed that rare event.
"Let's try to get a better reading on that planet,"
Danny suggested.
"And I think it's time we send out the word so that Exgal and the New Republic can get some scientists out there."
Teyubo went to the transmitter and clicked open the normal channel for accessing the galactic net and contacting Exgal.
It didn't work.
"Have the Dovan vessels tightened their lock on the planet?"
the huge and powerful Prefect Degara told his crew. His crew on the asteroid, which wasn't an asteroid at all, but rather a huge 10-kilometer chunk of Yorick coral, a living world ship. Degara motioned one of the tattooed warriors off on his task to the Dovan basals, the organisms that propelled the world ship. Possessed of an ability to lock onto specific gravity fields to the exclusion of all others, even to gravity fields millions of kilometers away, the adult 3-meter spherical Dovan basals worked like perpetual thrusters. And the more they focused their line, the greater the pull. Now they were locked on a planet the inhabitants of this galaxy called Helska 4. This is where the Praetorite Vong Invasion Force would set up its base of operations. They had set course as per the specific directions of Yeoman Carr's Philip Beacon, which had been left out at Vector Prime, the breach point of the Galactic Rim. Degara almost reconsidered his order, for Yeoman Carr's instructions had called for a steady run to the fourth planet. But if Carr had done his job correctly, no one would be the wiser. And the prefect had been to the main holding compartment of the world ship to communicate with the great Yamosk, the war coordinator, and the gigantic creature, its bulbous head glowing red with eagerness, its many tentacles coiled and twitching, had clearly revealed to him its desire to begin. As they began their final approach to Helska 4, out behind the world ship, dozens of single-piloted coral skippers fanned out, carrying with them a huge membranous sail. They inverted that sail into a semicircle, slowing the huge, living vessel. The coral skippers brought the world ship in, and it connected with the planet, not with the great explosion those watching from afar had expected, but with a dull splat, the membranes shielding and buffeting the impact like a gigantic mattress. Degara
like the other 5,000 Yuzhong Vong aboard, moved to his locker and coaxed out a fleshy, membranous creature, a variation of the Uglith masker, called an Uglith cloaker. With help from the prefect, the creature rolled up over his legs and enveloped him. Unlike the masker, the cloaker's facial mask was transparent, showing the glory of its host's disfigurements. Degara scooped up a soft, star-shaped creature from the water tank beside him and held it up to his face, where it latched on. The prefect gagged a bit as the central tendril of the Nullith snaked down his throat. But then the connection was complete, and the creature breathed from the water within Degara's body, while Degara pulled in needed oxygen through his nose. The Yamusk led the way out of the world ship, its thicker tentacles spreading wide to get a solid grip on the icy surface. Then the creature exposed its huge central tooth, and with the force of an ion cannon, drove it down into the ice. After nearly an hour, the tooth broke through, and the Yamusk wasted no time in contorting its huge and boneless body, sliding down into the watery world below. Degara and his crew went next, slipping under the water, where the Nullith they had latched upon their faces would do the breathing for them, and the Uglith cloakers would protect them from the freezing temperatures. The coral skippers flew to the higher docking bay on the ship, and there they awaited the orders of the war coordinator. All 15 scientists watched intently as the small blip approached the planet, and then nothing. Not an explosion, not the vaporizing of the ice planet, nothing. All the data coming back from this object had been inconclusive, showing them no signs of anything familiar in its composition. And now this. Garth, did you get that communications tower fixed? Danny asked rather sharply.
Working on it,
the man replied in a defensive tone. Danny's look showed no compromise.
I'll do it,
he said, throwing his hands up in defeat, and he stormed out of the room.
We've got to contact Exgal, Benson remarked. Either with the tower or from space.
That's just what we'll do, Danny interjected. We'll take the spacecaster to the fourth planet, and we'll give a call out to the Galactic Net on the way.
Jason heard the telltale hiss and electric snapping as he approached the main chamber of the Millennium Falcon. Anakin was in there, he realized, practicing with his lightsaber again. Always practicing. Normally, Jason would leave his little brother alone, knowing that the two of them simply couldn't come to any philosophical agreements in their present states of mind. This time, though, after the spectacle of the council meeting, Jason was in the mood for a good argument, so he moved through the hatch. His little brother was getting good, Jason had to admit, as Anakin brought the glowing blade down in a cross to the left, up high to the left, and back over to the right in a flashing sequence, each movement neatly picking off an energy missile. The sequence ended, and Anakin clicked his blade off and stood breathing heavily. Jason was shaking his head.
When you're practicing, what are you thinking about? What fantasy battles do you wage in these sessions?
Why does it matter?
Anakin snapped.
Because that's not the truth of the Force, Jason answered just as sharply. You keep thinking of it as a tool, a weapon in your war against everything you see as bad. But that is such a limiting philosophy.
It is a weapon, Anakin replied slowly. A powerful weapon and a great responsibility. Jason shook his head again.
The Force is a method of serenity and truth, not an outward projecting tool to be used to further any single person's perception of good.
I'm getting sick of hearing all of this, Anakin remarked.
You'll hear it until you learn the truth,
Jason replied immediately. That is my responsibility.
Uncle Luke told you that?
This isn't about him, Jason replied. It's about you and me.
He's going to put the Jedi Council back together,
Anakin said, as if those words gave him a victory.
He has to,
Jason said, his tone making it clear that he wasn't happy about the admission.
or risk disaster because of the other Jedi Knights like you, running through the galaxy, righting every wrong? He waved his hands dismissively at his brother and turned to leave.
Yeoman Carr set up shop openly. Too many were about for him to hope to accomplish his tasks without discovery. He hung up lights and made no effort to conceal the clanking of metallic tools. Sure enough, Danny Kui came out to him within the hour to find him hard at work on the spacecaster. Had she come out earlier, when Yeoman Carr had been disconnecting the final signal initiator on the communications port, she might have figured that something was amiss. "I'm leaving in 3 hours," she informed him.
"Just checking the vital systems," he replied.